Today is Thursday, July 13th, 2006. My name is Sandy Fahler, and I'm an interviewer for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today I am interviewing Nancy Keller, professor in the departments of plant pathology and food microbiology and toxicology in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Hello.
Hello.
We're going to start with your early life. If you would talk about where and when you were born, describe your childhood, your early schooling, talk about any people in your life when you were young that were younger that were influential in your pursuit of education.
Oh, sure. I was born in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania in 1955. Grew up in State College, Pennsylvania. It's probably pertinent, I guess, that State College is the site of Penn State University, so I grew up in a university town and was quite aware of students there, and maybe the whole thought of college was prominent in my brain. I don't know, I've not really thought about it that deeply.
Were your parents involved in the college?
My parents weren't, but my granddad, in fact I do remember this, my granddad was a professor at Penn State, and I'm the second professor in our family. And he actually has a building named after him. And I got out of a day of fifth grade, and I like that to go for the opening of the building.
What is his name?
His name is J. Orvis Keller. And he actually was the person that started, let's see, what's the right term for this? I guess outreach for Penn State. He was an engineer, but he got more into education as time went on, and he established an arm of Penn State in Turkey, and I know he and Grandmom lived there for two or three years, and then also in Japan. So, and I never knew him well because he died when I was in third grade, but he was an interesting man. He also apparently wrote Western novels, but always thought they were so lousy that he threw them away. And he painted. I actually have several of his, some of the pictures he painted, but really never made it big enough because I was too young to know him well. Yeah, and as I say, he's in Turkey and Japan half the time.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have two brothers, two older brothers, John and David. And they were and remained an important part of my life. I, of course, love them, but I enjoy them very much. They're interesting and fun folks.
What did your parents do?
My dad was a car insurance agent. In fact, I think he still has one or two clients, amazingly. He's in his 80s and so are they. Mom was a housekeeper. And we had a dog, too, but he lived for 18 years, so he's a very big memory in my life, a very positive memory.
Did you go to public school?
Yes, I did, yeah. And I enjoyed school. I certainly did. I was trying to think, were there any teachers, or did I have somebody who really made a big impression on me? Not that much. My fifth grade teacher did a bit, Mrs. Brewer. I remember her well. But I was pretty much into playing when I was in elementary school. And in high school, I always enjoyed science and art, but I did well, but I wasn't an overachiever. I always enjoyed doing things with my friends a lot too, and I.
What year were you born?
55. Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of teachers I recall very well in high school. But I don't know what maybe you're searching for something. I don't think there was one that said, oh man, you should be a scientist.
Right.
You're brilliant here. Go into science.
Well, now, did you think you wanted to be a scientist when you were in high school?
I knew I liked art and science the most. That's all I knew. And math. I liked math. But I realized I did enough. I'm not quite sure if this was high school or early I think it was high school, pre-college. Math was my best subject, actually. Effortless. But I couldn't really see how I would use math further on. Seemed like to my, as a naive high schooler, that the only thing you could do with math was teach it, and that didn't sound very exciting to me. Whereas, certainly with art, it's very expressive, you can design and create. And I must have felt the same way about science. What is interesting is my best science teachers were in biology, and I regret to say I had a very poor one in physics. And to this day, like, physics still is a black hole to me, and biology is always what I've liked a lot. And my chemistry teachers were so-so in high school.
But you knew that you were going on to college.
Yeah. I think I was, there was no doubt about that. I was probably, and in fact, when I entered college, my first year, I double majored in biology and art.
How did you choose your college?
Well, I didn't. That's an interesting story. I took the SATs, and I got a very, I got good grade, good scores, I guess. And I didn't really think very much of college. I sort of, not that interested in it. Well, a big thing happens, actually. I had a major operation on my back. And so during my senior year in high school, I was either in the hospital or in a hospital bed in my home for a lot of it, because I had a spinal operation, spinal fusion. So I sort of wasn't that interested, and Dad just, I remember talking with Dad and Mom, and their Dad really is the one who applied, and I just say, oh yeah, that sounds good. And I'm not quite sure the criteria he used, honestly, but they were Penn State, of course, because I lived there, but he, North Carolina, South Carolina, William and Mary, all in those areas. And I was accepted, I think I was accepted by all of them, and I was accepted by William and Mary, which I guess isn't that easy to get in. And I remember one of the counselors in our school, high school, coming to me saying, oh, he's really excited. Oh, Nancy got in William and Mary. That's so exciting. I didn't feel terribly excited one way or the other about it, really, because I guess I was focusing on other things. Whatever reason, I went to William and Mary, but I can't say I was particularly interested in going or not going, because I think I still sort of reeling or because of health issues. So I went there, and that's where I did a double major. But after a year there, I didn't want to stay there. I wanted to come back to Penn State. So I transferred back to Penn State.
Why didn't you want to stay?
I think it was because I wanted to be, maybe I wasn't ready to be from home. I wanted to be with my high school friends. I really think that was a lot of it.
Did a lot of them go on to college?
Yes, they did. So at state colleges, I don't know if this is typical, what happens here in Madison, I just don't know. Here's Penn State University. State High and State College get some of the best scores in Pennsylvania, just as I think it does here. Mm-hmm. A lot of the, again, not in my family, but many of the students at State High and State College are kids of professors, so they we get a lot of scholastic scholars, and it's just, with a big university that dominates a small town, I think you sort of think, oh, I'm going on, and many people go on to Penn State.
Mm-hmm. So you enrolled at Penn State?
Yes, I did, yeah. And I had a great time at Penn State.
Did you live at home?
No, I didn't. Yeah, I didn't want to live at home. Did I ever live at home? I don't think so. I never went to the dorms. I was in the dorms at William & Mary. I didn't like dorms. Maybe that was a reason. I was in an apartment, or one year I was at my grandmom's house for part of the time, yeah. I was usually just with friends. And then I decided just to major in science. I switched because I realized if I kept on double major with art and science and they had such dissimilar requirements, I might be in school for 6 years, which seemed a long time then. I guess these days it doesn't seem so long. So I just switched into science completely, thinking that I could always do art on the side, but that's not really true. And I always, I don't know, for a good many years, though, I always took art courses on the side. And now I just don't have time to do it. I wish I did. I really miss that. I like watercolor especially.
Did you, was your career, your education at Penn State successful as far as you were concerned? Good classes, good professors?
Yes, yeah. Obviously some were better than others. Again, I had to take a lot of required science. In general, I found my required courses the most boring. And I, very typical with many people, I think my freshman year in William & Mary and my sophomore year, maybe I wasn't as serious about things, whereas my junior and senior I was. But I remember enjoying my last 2 years the most. My enjoyment, though, had a lot to do with I'd gotten rid of the requirements, so it was also with school. I took a lot of fun electives. My most fun courses were not in science, actually. I took art history, Renaissance history, Greek mythology. I still remember these being the most fun courses. I ended up that last year, I did take a few fun science ones. That I just sort of liked. And I ended up taking that last year with one of my brothers who had dropped out of school and came back, and it was a lot of fun to be in with him. Mm-hmm. David's also very good in science, and he and I just sort of play around and race each other to see who could finish a class or a test first. We both do very well, gifted in that area, I'd say, to some degree. I mean, no more than anyone else who majors in it. And then I always worked. And I enjoyed that. I worked at a restaurant and had a lot of good friends there. And
you were a waitress?
Yeah, I was a waitress, yeah. Uh-huh. I enjoyed that a lot. Uh-huh. So really, I just had a lot of fun. I still didn't put that much energy into my classes. I always did well, but I still was focused a lot on just enjoying being with my friends and other things.
Well, what did you do when you graduated?
I joined the Peace Corps. Oh. No, I didn't do that first. My older brother married a woman, Jenny, whose parents lived in Australia. They were originally U.S. citizens. And John, my brother, had a master's degree in history and couldn't find any position here. And at the time, there were still openings for teachers in Australia, so Jenny's dad told him, oh, why don't you come over there, and they did. And I thought, oh, wow, this will be fun, I'll go to Australia, because I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I was sort of thinking of medical school, but I wasn't quite sure. And this is advice I'd give to anyone. If you're not quite sure about grad school yet, don't do it. So I went to Australia. And when I was there for a couple months, I had a great time. I had a wonderful time there. And then I was thinking, though, about my future, truly. And I just thought, I'm just not ready for grad school. I like traveling. This is so much fun, seeing other cultures. But I'd like to feel maybe I'd be doing something helpful. So I decided to join the Peace Corps. Mm-hmm. So when I got back, I applied. And I worked a little bit while I was waiting for whether I'd be accepted or not. I was. And I went to a country called Lesotho. It's in southern Africa. Mm-hmm. And I was in the Peace Corps for 3+ years.
What did you do?
Well, I was for 2 of the years, I was a science teacher. Sometimes I taught math. I almost got the chance to teach religion, but then the nuns thought better of asking me to do that. I was looking forward to it, to be truthful, but then they just thought my attitude wasn't correct.
So were you working with a Catholic charity group?
Or? Yeah. Well,
Catholic Church?
It's a Catholic church. Very interesting. In Lesotho, it's a small country, mm-hmm. and One thing I think healthy or strong for the people in Lesotho, that's just one group of people called the Basotho. So there aren't different groups or tribes. And when they became, well, so it's a landlocked country within South Africa. And at this time in South Africa, there's a lot of black tribes, but also the Boers, the Afrikaners, mm-hmm. and the English were there, and they're starting to battle each other. And the at that time, the king of the Basotho people, Moshoeshoe, sort of recognized that, wow, it looks like these white folks are going to take over our lands anyways. I better get someone to maybe protect us. And he aligned with the English. I can't remember the details why. And so they actually helped preserve some of the land for Lesotho by keeping the Afrikaners away during the British-Afrikaner fight. And then this land became known as Basotho land. It was an English protectorate for many years. And it gained its independence in, I think it's the 1960. Well, the same time that Moshoeshoe was working with the British, he also, and I can't remember the story of this exactly either, but you know, there's missionaries all over the place. So there's this French, or was it French-Canadian? I can't remember. Maybe it's a French missionary, Catholic, became a good friend of Moshoeshoe's. And after some time, I believe he converted Moshoeshoe, and Moshoeshoe said, we will be Roman Catholics. And when I was in Lesotho, so many years ago, was it more than 50% of the people were Catholic? And the Catholic Church gave quite a bit of money there, and so many of the schools were run by Catholic missions. And I was at this mission up in the mountains. It's a mountainous country. It was run by the Catholic mission.
There, were you Catholic?
No, no, it didn't. That wasn't a requirement.
No, but that's probably why they didn't recommend that you teach.
Well, it would have been, no, this is a whole other story. I don't think we should go here. It depended on the nun. The first year, the first year, I really liked the head nun. But then they transfer them all the time. She was a Basotho woman. And they got another nun, a Basotho woman. She was a maniac. I just think the lady was insane. And she stopped teaching. And this is really, so we taught 7th, 8th, and 9th graders. And at 9th grade, you had to take a test in order to go on to high school. And one of your classes had to be religion. And she just stopped teaching them. So they thought they were going to fail. So I said I'd offer. But when I offered, that roused her, because she sure didn't want me teaching religion. She started teaching again. It was a very humorous episode. I have so many stories from there.
Well, did you ever feel in danger from this fighting that was going on around you?
Oh, the Boer, the Afrikaners and English fighting was the last century. That was all finished.
Oh, so there were friendly borders and no...
Relatively so, yeah. Yeah, there's nothing to worry about. Mm-hmm. Now, I was a couple... What was interesting is I was there... Oh... 79, 80, 81, left early 82... In South Africa, which surrounded us, they were still under the apartheid system. And there was all sorts of things brewing. You could sense that, oh, you know, things are going to be happening there soon. But the conversion from the Afrikaner system to supposedly equality for everybody occurred after I left. But there were a lot of things going on where you could see something was going to happen, and it was an interesting time to be there.
Have you ever been back?
No, but I'd love to. That's one of my goals, so I'm sure. I actually do some collaborations with some folks in Republic of South Africa, and someday I want to go. It's sort of fitting it in my schedule, but I'm sure I'll go again. And I actually still write with a few of my old students.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, what happened after the 3 years in the Peace Corps?
Oh, well, then as time was going, you know, I had to start thinking of my future, and I decided I do want to go to graduate school. I don't want to go to medical school, but I liked, I think, the idea of healing. So I decided to do plant pathology, so studying helping sick plants. And I believe the decision, there are many little things that steered me that way. One thing was one of the, well, I still sort of interested in, I think, helping or healing or stuff. And when I was there, I noticed that actually where I lived in Lesotho, people would have enough food calorie-wise often, but it wasn't the best type of food. And often the kids, they would get all this free food and it would be moldy, didn't smell well. I just saw that food, it gave me a whole nother way to look at food actually when I was there than from being in this country. Mm-hmm. And I realized this was, of course I knew this, I knew this before coming, but this really made me say that, oh wow, getting food is, or having decent food is not that easy for a lot of people. And that really had a big effect on me. I liked agriculture. And then one of the leaders, I'm not thinking of the right name, the agricultural wing of the Peace Corps there was a former Cornell grad. And he said, oh, Nancy, Cornell is great for international ag. I really got interested in agriculture. All our departments are good. And I ended up going to Cornell for plant pathology. And I took my... a humorous story is I took my GREs in Lesotho, the first person in the history of that country to do it. It was very humorous.
Now, they don't have higher education.
Yeah, they have a college.
Oh.
Yeah, they do. Uh-huh. They had a university. And that's where I took it. We had to order tests from Princeton. These were still the written ones. I don't know what they do now. Of course, they do have computers there, so... And we got these special, got this bundle of tests. They only gave them in packages of 20 or 25. That was the funny part. The woman, a professor in the college there, gave it to me. And it was just so funny because she knew I was the only person taking it. But she got this room that held, 25 people. And she laid out tests at all 25, put a pencil at all 25, an eraser at all 25. And then I was the only person sitting there. And then she read the instructions, and what cracked me up is she said, you may not cheat and look at the paper on either side of you. And I don't know, I just suppressed laughing so hard. But that was funny.
So was that the only school that you applied to? You knew you wanted Cornell.
No, I applied to a couple of them. Mm-hmm. But Cornell was the one I ultimately chose. Part of that, I think Cornell wasn't necessarily the reputation. I've always been a little naive on checking on reputations and stuff, but it was near my parents, and I thought it might be nice to be a little near them so I could visit every now and then.
Well, talk about the experience then in graduate school.
Oh, grad school, all in all, I enjoyed that very much. I got both my master's and my PhD at Cornell, and when I started out, I thought I just wanted a master's. I thought I'd get a master's and I'd go back into international ag. That's what I thought. I was really interested in that and traveling and hoping to help grow some crops somewhere. Mm-hmm. So I had a very applied master's. I did a type of work outside in the fields looking at a disease on maize. And it went well. Enjoyed my classes and my made friends forever. I had a very good advisor, Gary Bergstrom. I was wonderful. I was his first student. He was a new professor there, and he just is a wonderful man. But that was fun. And what was interesting, though, is my master's was coming to an end. Then, having been at Cornell, I remember what happened is we had to go to seminars every week, just like most departments here where you'd have a seminar in your specialty. And it was an interesting time to be in plant pathology. I started in 1982 because traditionally plant pathology has been a very applied science. You'd go into the field and you'd try to find, there'd be diseases you're worried about, maybe do some breeding to find a line of plant that's resistant to disease, or try to find some treatment, liming the soil or so forth. And this is very important, and this continues to this day. But we're at the point when I was in grad school that there had been some great advances in molecular biology, and people were starting to be able to look at just a hint that you could get into the genomes of some of the microorganisms, mm-hmm. or not a genome, except for viruses, a gene, let's say. And there's some interesting biochemistry, and I'd be going to these seminars, and I didn't know what people were talking about. I knew all about the field stuff, but when biochemistry or structures or some little hints to molecular work came up, I just didn't understand it. I didn't have the jargon or the background. And I remember it sort of made me angry. That must be my personality. If I don't understand something at first, it's like a defense. So, but then, you know, I said, oh, I've got to understand this. So I started getting interested, and I decided I would remain for a PhD and go to a lab where they were doing molecular stuff. Hmm. I guess I should add is I have always worked with fungi, this group of organisms, as pathogens, and I love fungi. I just enjoy them very much. The fifth kingdom, a kingdom to themselves, very complex and interesting organisms. And at that time at Cornell, one of the foremost leaders in starting to work with DNA and genes of plant pathogenic fungi was Olin Yoder. And he became my advisor for my PhD. Gary Bergstrom stayed on. So both of these men really had a great influence on me. And in Olin's lab, I did my PhD work, which was really, this is a very novel question at the time, is asking if foreign DNA was stable in the fungus, and would it affect the ability of the fitness of the fungus in colonizing its host? Really very simple but basic questions. And I think that PhD taught me a lot. It was before we really had access to the full genomes, and it wasn't that easy to clone a gene of your choice. So I was basically performing pretests that, okay, we know we can transform fungi now and put DNA in. What does that do to them? So that was my doctorate. And
Did you know at that time then that you wanted to teach and continue your research that you...
Yeah, I guess at that time I knew I wanted to continue doing research with fungi. I really like that. I don't think I was necessarily saying I wanted to become a professor and teach. I was thinking just more immediately of wanting to do more research at a postdoc level. And so in fact, what happened is, as I was getting near the end of my PhD, I started thinking, well, what do I want to do next? And at that time, this category of postdoctoral associate was a very common one. It had really, especially if you're in molecular biology. The other thing is for personal life enjoyment, when I'm not doing science, I love to be outside. I'm an outdoors person. I like to ride bikes, blah, blah, blah. But for intellectually, what stimulates me is at the cellular level. So I knew I wasn't going to go back to doing field research, though I appreciate it very much. But what really grabbed me was understanding what's going on in cell biology, and I like genetics and all of this. Mm-hmm. So I had to pick the topic, and I think this is important. Where am I going to do what I'm going to study? And I tell my students this, so this is important. Near the end of my PhD, we had an adjunct professor come to give us a seminar. This was Dr. Paul Nelson from Penn State University. And Dr. Nelson was world-renowned for his work on mycotoxins. These are toxins produced by fungi that are injurious to animals and people, sometimes plants. And he gave his presentation to us. And I remember he was talking about a particular new disease called equine leukoencephalomalacia. that's a big word. What it is there was a toxin produced by a type of fungus called Fusarium. This toxin is called fumonisin, and it has devastating effects on horses. It's tragic, actually. Basically, it liquefies their brains, and they die. But what he was saying, it actually affects all mammals to some degree. And he, along with his collaborator in the Republic of South Africa, had found that this compound was in the cornmeal that everybody in Southern Africa eats. Oh, and as he was talking, you know, it's just like I went back to my Peace Corps days, and I not only did I think, well, I probably ate this stuff too, but it brought back these memories of my students getting all this free maize meal from, you know, it came from the US, Netherlands, whatever, and sometimes it'd just be so bad they wouldn't even eat it. And these kids were hungry. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, oh, I bet you it was full of all these molds and toxins. And it's like a moment of clarity for me, one moment of real clarity, and I thought, I want to study mycotoxins. And so I did my earnest,
when you made the decision. Okay,
so when I made the decision, what I wanted to do was find a lab in the United States where they were tackling the mycotoxin problem at a molecular genetic level. And there were only three. Most people were still doing sort of veterinarian stuff where you would give animals a certain amount of toxin, watch them die. I didn't want to do that. So there was two positions in the United States Department of Agriculture and one in North Carolina State. For various reasons, I chose the one in one of the USDA labs, and that lab happened to be in New Orleans. So I went down to New Orleans for my postdoc, and that's what shaped me. Your postdoc is very important because it's often the topic in your postdoc that you take on as an assistant professor. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened that these people worked not with the Fusarium fungi, but with the Aspergillus fungi. Aspergillus is well known or infamous for making aflatoxin. Aflatoxin is a mycotoxin that causes liver cancer. There's plenty of that in Africa too, and we get it in this country every year, but we actually check our crops, so we'll destroy them if there's too much aflatoxin. So I did a postdoc there, and that's when I was there. I can't remember if it really was clarified as a postdoc or I thought of this in grad school. I'm not really sure, but then I did know I wanted to go. I wanted to be a professor at a university, mm-hmm. and.
So was that for 2 years?
It was 2 years, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was 2 years. In fact, what happened, I hadn't even been there very long when there was an opening at Texas A&M University looking for somebody to study mycotoxins. Hmm. You know, like, so, and then I met the professor, the head of the department, who is a good friend of mine, Dr. Neil Van Alphen, at a meeting, and he was telling me about it. He said, oh, why don't you apply, Nancy? And I had just been in my postdoc for about a year. But I applied, went for an interview, and they offered me a job, and I thought, well, I better go for that. But I wanted to stay with my postdoc post long enough to finish a project. I just didn't want to leave it hanging, so I did. Mm-hmm. And that was okay with Texas A&M. So I was at my postdoc for almost exactly 2 years.
And they said, we'll wait for you.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I think they offered me the position, I can't remember, it was spring, and I didn't arrive there until November, something like that. But they were busy recruiting a lot of people. Neil is really fantastic person and a great administrator, and very good. Texas A&M had recruited him to basically turn the plant path department around, and he's very good at negotiating, and he said, well, sure, fine, I can do this, but then I need a lot of leeway, and I want to be able to hire X new positions, a fantastic amount. And first of all, he started off with four new positions, and I was one of these. And of the four, three he hired were fungal molecular biologists. Hmm. And really what happened there is we created one of the strongest fungal molecular biology groups in the country. Mm-hmm. It was with R in plant path and with biology. They're still very strong.
Were all of you new to the to new professors?
Not all of us, but a lot of us were. There's us three new ones in plant path, two new ones in biology, and then there were some folks that are already established.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you can imagine, with five new people and you get a lot of energy, and it was really pretty exciting. And
and this was a tenure track position?
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And
how long did you stay there?
I was there for quite a while. I started in, if I get all the years right, in 1990 or 1991, something like that. And then I started here in 2001. But I would say there's where I really got a lot of things established in my research, and we started to make some really nice progress in understanding, finding the genes in the fungus that make aflatoxins, and starting to understand what regulated them. I continue to do this until this day, but made a lot of progress in those days. And
where really did you get your funding?
At Texas A&M.
Mm-hmm.
At Texas A&M, I got funding from the NRI. This is the competitive granting for USDA. So I did get some there. I think I got my first NSF grant there too. Yes, I did. I got commodity money. The corn growers in Texas were really a great group of people. I really enjoyed and miss them to this day. Every year, the corn in Texas gets aflatoxin. And these growers, grower groups all over, you know, you don't have to, but you can put in money, and they get money, and then they give it to researchers. And so they knew aflatoxin was a big problem, so they fund several folks who are looking, trying to find ways to stop aflatoxin. A couple other grower groups. Texas A&M has some internal competitive money that I would get from there at the time, and I think even to this day, quite a bit more than Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Industry, I got some funding from industry. And to this day too, USAID, United States International Aid.
Mm-hmm.
I've always, since day one, I've always, I carried it here. It's really amazing to carry it here to UW. But it's not a big part of the work, but it's very important to me to have some connection with someone in international ag, so this is my way of doing it. So I've always actually had somebody I collaborate with in, or collaborate, I don't know if that's the exact word, is on the same grant with me in Africa. You can't really do the same things in many of the labs in Africa, because honestly, it's just, they just don't have the means or the equipment nor money. But I've always kept some sort of tie with somebody, and then they do the appropriate research in Africa to try to find means and ways to try to stem aflatoxin mm-hmm. contamination.
Very good.
Yeah.
Now, you went through the tenure process then at Texas A&M.
Yes, I did, yeah.
Anything
yeah.
you want to talk about that?
Well, not really. I don't know if people want to hear this or not. I never worried about tenure. I just didn't. And it's probably more because I just didn't think about it. I was too interested in my research. And I know at work I'm very one-minded. That's both good and bad. All your traits, right, have a positive and negative. And I'm just so focused on it because it's so interesting to me. I don't see a lot of other things or think about them. As I say, there's both positive and negative things for that. So I didn't have time to think about tenure. I just didn't bother. And it went very well. Yeah.
Well, why did you come to Wisconsin?
Well, yeah, you have that question asked. That's probably an area I won't go into exactly too much because a lot was personal reasons.
Oh, yeah.
I was recruited quite heavily here, and that was flattering. And I said no twice, but they kept on going. But a lot had to do with personal reasons, and it was one reason why it was really, really, really hard is I really like my colleagues at Texas A&M, and mm-hmm. I still miss them, actually. Mm-hmm. There's some very great people here, too, but it certainly wasn't because of my department at Texas mm-hmm. A&M, which is just a great place to work.
What did you know anything about this department before you came?
Yeah, I'd heard some things about it.
Was it a strong department?
Yeah, well, it is. It's a strong department. It's this is funny to me though. This is probably my unique thing is, you know, you have reputations of departments all over the states in every profession. And traditionally, and I've never explored history enough to know exactly why, but Cornell, Wisconsin, Davis, I think to some degree North Carolina State, there were a few that were saying, oh, these are the top plant pathology departments. And I'm sure a lot had to do with some really great people there. I think part of it is almost when it was started. So this department has always been very strong up here, and I knew that. I think we could reconsider some because Texas A&M wasn't considered one of the strongest, and I think, fine one. And I think Neil and all the folks that came down there have just really turned it around. But this is sort of off on the side, but I think it's very hard. So I think Texas A&M is very strong in plant path too, and I feel it's very hard for a southern university in this country to get the ranking they really deserve. Mm-hmm. It's been very educational for me to live in the South for so long, and I just don't feel they're treated well. Mm. And I get little remarks I've heard here that have bothered me, actually. Mm-hmm. So I put that out mm-hmm. there. I knew that this department was very strong in bacteriology, and they remain so, and I'm trying to. They needed someone in the fungal group, but I think we need more than just me. So
it is different then.
It is.
You don't have the colleagues there.
I don't.
That's so what do you do about that?
Well, that was really hard for me, honestly. Now one thing is when I came here, I had a mature program. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I knew what I was going to do, and I want to give praise to the folks that came up with me. When I finally decided this, I had a fairly big group, and I said, you know, guys, they're all guys except for one woman. I said, I'm making this decision, but I'm not going to go unless you guys go. And all of them, except for one, said yes. And that was one of my postdocs. She was the woman. She was very close to finishing anyways, and her husband was teaching at high school there. Uh-huh. So she ended up staying down there, and the department was really good and let her stay in my lab until she finished. But I had 6 guys with me, postdocs or grad students, and they moved everything, and these men put the lab together for me very nicely, because at the same time, well, this is a big factor too, I was a new mom. Mm. Now I'll tell you, you should really think about moving a little. Maybe I wasn't wise when you think of all those stress factors. So I actually didn't even have child care at first for my first month here. It was very difficult. I just didn't think enough. But these, my students and postdocs, just did a wonderful job in putting, and they have a special place of affection in my heart because of that. I don't know, where I sort of got an tangent there. Mm-hmm. What else?
So you brought your research with you.
So I did. And so, you know, I didn't have, there aren't, in this department, I actually don't collaborate with anyone in this department. But because my lab was mature, I was really doing a lot myself anyways, and I had a lot of collaborators anyways that were outside the university. I had a collaborator in the USDA, so hey, you know, he's in Peoria, Illinois, whether I was at Texas or Wisconsin, it really didn't matter. And I started forging new collaborations, and I actually am, now there are people on campus I do collaborate with, not just in this, not in this department though. And what you really find is, you see where you have the holes in your expertise, and then you go find the expert and see if that person can work with you. And often the person isn't at your university either. I think what I really wanted with having a lot of fungal people around isn't necessarily collaboration, because I didn't collaborate with everyone down at A&M, but it's so rich for your grad students and postdocs to have people that understand what you're doing and can give you advice. But it's not, what I found then as I started looking around, because I really was thinking of my students a lot too, as I explore, there actually are a lot of fungal biologists on campus who will use some of the same tools I do. They're just not, they're in other departments. And for example, there's a very strong group here on medical mycologists. Very good group. And I've actually started working in with medical fungi myself, too. And the new building's going to be wonderful because a whole bunch of the fungal people who use molecular biochemical tools are going to be in the same floor, and it'll be wonderful. Yeah, so you just look and seek. And I work with, what's nice here, too, on this area of medical mycology, I actually collaborate with Dr. David Andes here on campus, who is a PhD MD. He's actually a physician on infectious diseases, and he just noted, I don't know, the whole history, he's someone to talk to too, but you know, a lot of his patients, they start with one disease, but they end up getting a fungal disease. So he's very interested in trying to, you know, find ways to combat that. Mm-hmm. So anyways, over time, I found the folks.
Mm-hmm. Would you talk about your teaching?
Oh yeah, I teach two main classes here. I think that's what you want. All of us, including myself, will give a presentation here in that class. That's not the main thing, I think. My whole life, I've taught a class called Introductory Plant Pathology, and when I say that, all my professional, even started when I was in grad school. I taught the lab for that.
Is that an undergraduate course?
It's an undergrad, though. A lot of grad students take it if you're going to get a degree in plant path. And then I taught the course at Texas A&M, and I teach it here.
And you like that?
Well,
is it usually a big group?
It's a big group. yeah, yes and no, being honest. I've taught it for so long. Maybe I'm a little tired of teaching it. I always like it when I have some students who get real excited with this. It's really fun to see undergrad who gets real excited about something. But there's a slew of students that take the class that feel it's just one more elective they have to take, and there's some resentment towards that. So I can say I have mixed feelings towards this class.
Are you a good teacher?
Am I a good teacher? Oh, I would say, if you look at the ratings and stuff, I'm your average teacher. I know I appeal to some students very, very much. I've had many students over the years who've said, you're the best I've ever had. But then there's a subset that don't like how I teach. And I have some clues how it is, but I'm get excited with what I teach often on some of the areas, especially the areas I really like, and a lot of students like that, and to others, I don't know, I don't think they do for some reason. I'm not a monotone teacher, and that's, I don't know.
Is the best part of your teaching responsibility the working with the grad students?
Oh, it is by
far.
Talk
about that. I mean, you have so far. That there, it sounds like it's almost like a family.
Well, we have a very good group. We do, and I I think all my students, when they leave, they stay in contact with me forever. And I've had very nice things my grad students have told me. Maybe they don't realize everything while they're here, but I honestly do think we have one of the best good feeling. I put a lot of time into my grad students. So I teach a grad student class too, which I enjoy. Co-teach with JOQ at Food Research Institute. That's fun. Grad students have a different approach to often classes than undergrads, and you know they really want to know this stuff too. It's there, so it's a whole different way of teaching. So that's fun. But I feel teaching, I mentor my grad students, and that's very important to me. I want them to succeed and do as well as they can in life, and so I want their research to go well, but I also try to teach them skills or realities of working in academia, things that I didn't get. And I don't want to, you know, put down anybody, but certainly I wasn't taught some of the realities of how you get ahead in world, tricks and trades of writing grants, of knowing people, of what you say, all sorts of things. So we are just really pragmatic and talk about what life will be like afterwards, what you should gain here. But it's a great joy to me, of course, to see if I have a student who does, of course, well with me, but then I just now, I'm, you know, starting to see some of my students who've gotten PhDs from me some years ago, where they're heading. And I keep in close contact with my postdocs, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my grad students, I put possibly a little bit more time, and we have longer years, but I keep in close contact with my grads, with my postdocs too, and just want to see how well they're doing and try to help them wherever I can. So, it's, yeah, well, it is like a family too. I remember my advisor in grad school, Gary Bergstrom, he showed me early on. He said, "Well, Nancy, look at this," and he brings out this chart, and it has his name, Bergstrom, and then above him, Nicholson, and so anyways, he said, so Ralph Nicholson is your grandfather. I got my PhD from him, and you're getting so, and this is funny. So I actually like that now,
uh-huh.
So I found it for Olin, and every now and then I'll tell my students this, so it's not the biggest profession in the world, so you can see, it's really interesting.
Sure.
From Olin's side of the family, everybody worked with fungal toxins for a long time, so we kept this toxin thing in me. And one of my PhD students, who's a scientist in Peoria now with the USDA, he's studying toxins, and one of my postdocs has gone into toxins. They're both scientists. Well, it's sort of interesting. They've
mm-hmm.
gone all over the place.
Do you have to teach your grad students how to write?
Yes. Well, yes and no. Of course, grad students, I guess, have to take writing. I don't know. Now, first of all, my grad students are from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll have grad students that are from this country, grad students from countries where you speak English pretty early on, and some from not. So that's a big factor right away. And obviously, somebody who knows English from day one is going to write grammatically at least much better than somebody who's from China. So for sure, especially the Asian countries, they need a bit more help. But then there's also logic that doesn't really necessarily have anything to do with the sentence structure, and then everyone varies in there. It doesn't matter what country you're from. There's just some people who sort of innately write well. They know that here's the lead sentence in the paragraph, and I want to talk about that, and this, and this, and that, and I've not seen any correlation with that, with where you're from.
Mm-hmm.
So I do with my grad students, when they're starting out and we're writing, we go back and forth. They'll send me a draft, and I'll say no, and I let them see how I've corrected it and why. Always they're always better by the time they go. But this is a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And I do this with postdocs too. Probably not quite as much time because I feel they should have gotten a lot of this in their PhD, but they don't all. It's not at all even. And then, so what happens when I come down to it, I've had some folks in the lab that haven't really needed that much from me and some that need a whole lot.
Do you enjoy writing?
Oh, I do. Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. And if I had to write, I write a lot of grants. And it's almost like, you know, I'm never in the lab anymore. I keep saying I go and do something. I have to live vicariously by their results. But I actually like writing. I like writing papers. I like writing grants. I like writing reviews. It's creative for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's very creative. But I get tired sometimes. And I mean, there's certain parts of a paper like materials and methods. Ugh, that's so boring to me. You know, but you have to do that just right. And I must say, I go over that one, and sometimes I'll have typos in there because I just didn't want to look at how many times you have to spin the centrifuge at how many RPMs. It's the it's taking the data and then saying, what does this mean and where are we going with it? That's fun for me. Mm-hmm.
Is it more difficult today to get money than it was?
Oh, my gosh, yes, it is. It is. There's no doubt about it. And I really feel for people starting out now. Mm. Yeah, the percentages, even let's say you look at three main federal grants. You have NIH, NSF, and the NRIs in agriculture. The percent funded is just going down abysmally. Like in NIH, I have to say I've been very fortunate this year. Amazingly so in a hard year, but like the panel, for example, just, you know, NIH, they used to historically fund maybe 30% people would get it. A panel I'm in right now, it's 14%. NSF would be 25, panel I'm in, 7%. NRI, same thing, it's down to 7%.
Hmm.
I know it's very disheartening for people.
And so much is going on when you think about it in science that
yeah.
could be done that isn't getting done.
Well, we certainly have very many opinions about this and where money is being.
It's true.
Yeah.
Have you become involved in faculty governance, committee work, or other campus activities, service activities?
Yeah, I do quite a bit. I haven't gotten into the governance. I don't know if I would or not, just the way I am. I actually still think, proportionally compared to many faculty, my mind is much more in my science and my research. And it gives me pure joy, and I'm good at that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how good I'd be at the other stuff. Now, having said that, I do a lot of committee stuff. That's important. It's very important. I'm like chair of the curriculum committee here, and I feel that's very important. So I put a lot of energy into important committees like
that.
What
does that committee do?
Oh, we review, we assign teaching duties to the professors every year. We're checking to see if the students are passing their classes okay, prelims. We reassess our classes. This is the right class or the wrong class. We look at comments of students on the other teachers. As a teacher, did they have a blimp this year? How can we help them? That just has a whole lot to do with any and all aspects of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I've been on some other ones too. There's quite a few committees I'm on and various. There's just a lot of things you have to keep going in a department. So I have to do a lot of stuff in the departmental level. I'm on the biosafety committee here at UW. I enjoy that one quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the rep from, the ag, I would say. And that's very important. The requirements for biosafety becoming more and more and more stringent, and 9/11 really shot that up.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to review everyone's protocols and see if they're following the right steps according to law, federal law, state law. That's a very interesting committee. And so that one's quite interesting. I'm also in the, just this year started, and this is very interesting too, gives you a little view of works. I'm on the Graduate School Committee. This is a committee that looks every year. There's some funding available for professors to write to get some money here to help. Usually it's like for a graduate. It's a big competition, and we have to mm-hmm. go through and interview all these professors, and because only a small, you know, well, actually larger than the other federal agencies, but, you know, only a percent can get them, so. And then there's some other awards in this committee. We also give out awards for various aspects of excellence professors have shown on campus. So that's, I enjoy that one quite a bit. I'll be starting at the, I'm the rep starting this fall for a senator from the Food Research Institute, so I'll get to see something about that. I'm on a lot of, actually, oh, I'm actually on a lot of, there, I'm a trainer in the environmental and toxicology, and I'm on two of the committees there. I like that. They're very organized. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it seems like I'm on too many committees. That's here on campus. I'm sure I'm forgetting a couple. And then I've done a lot of stuff professionally, which is important too. And it's just trying to fit it in, seeing what you can do. I've been president of one of the sections in ASM, American Society of Microbiology, in the division I belong to. I was a man. There's a very one, the biggest meeting that fungal geneticists would go to, fungal genetics, every 2 years. I was manager of it 1 year. I've been chair of a lot of these big meetings. That's a lot of fun, though, I must say. It's some work, but it's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
You mentioned the federal panels you're on.
Oh, yeah, I enjoy those a lot, too. I'm asked, as I'm sure most people are, once you know you're known and everyone thinks you're doing okay, you'll be asked for many more things you can do. I haven't been on, in fact, I say no to a lot of those panels. I just love to do more. I really like that. Now, a big consideration, this is going to come here, I can't do as much. I'm a single mom. Mm. So this really directs a whole lot of my travel. That's the most important thing. So I've said no to a lot of things because of that.
Sure. Would you talk about the climate for women here? How does it help and or hinder the participation and advancement of women?
Well, you know, I really don't have much remarks on this. I'm probably novel in that.
Where were you? Climate for women.
Oh, yeah. So I think it's pretty good here. Again, I don't... maybe I'll back up and say it this way. I do think there are obstacles to women climbing upwards. I very much do. And I think it gets harder as you get higher up. And it's not perfect here, and not perfect in many places. What I do know is that we do have some women at UW, and certainly in this department, I like to give a lot of credit to Joe Handelsman and Caitlin Allen, who are really doing their best to get the climate for women mm-hmm. just there. Our department is very, I guess I should add, is very unique. We have the highest percentage of women in plant path in the country, I'm pretty sure.
Hmm.
And they all do great jobs. Having said that, as I say, I think it is good. I myself haven't, maybe this is why I dealt with it. I never focused on that very much my whole time because, hey, it is as it is. I'm just going to do what I have to do. And I do. I know for sure there's some times when I wasn't accepted at first readily because I was a female, and probably that's still the case. But many of those cases, it became overturned as people knew me better. It's unfortunate that had to happen, but that is the case. And I think, though I'm not in organizations really to help, I believe I, on my own level, I personally help in my lab. I have heard it said, and I don't know this because I haven't witnessed this. So in any lab I was in, I was never treated differently because I was female. But I know a lot of females have told me, and some students have said, well, it's hard to be in that lab if you're female. It certainly isn't in my lab. And I spend actually some time with a lot of the females because, well, maybe this is, I've had several people have babies in my lab, and that's fine, you know, I think that's a good sign. You know, there's some traits, I think, that some young female scientists, and not to say male won't do it either, but a lot of female exhibit that don't help them. It's almost like apologize. It's not a strength response, and so I always like to talk to the people I work with about this. Well, you know, maybe, have you considered, don't say, well, I don't know if that's right, but say, this is what I got. And so I do a lot of work like that.
Good.
And I have a lot of good female friends in science, too, and we're always saying maybe we should just try to, I don't know. It is better, I think it's innate in human nature almost, that you treat this person who's a little bit different than you differently. But I, as I say, I know there's some big efforts here to try to erase as much as possible different treatment.
Do your female graduate, do your graduate students ask you for advice in negotiating when they try to get their first job?
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting question. Yes, in fact, I just had a postdoc right now. She just accepted a job. She's going to leave in a day or two. And I had inserted myself. She's going to ask me, but I have not done a good job at negotiating. And I realize this after the fact, and I don't want that to happen to somebody else again. And a lot is aggression. It's mm-hmm. You can't be nice and say, oh, that sounds nice. You can't. And that's unfortunate. I don't like it all, the system where funds are given, the brasher you are. I don't know. It's not a pleasant area for me, but I feel I did not do myself justice, and I don't want other people to have the same thing happen to them. Mm-hmm. I'd give that to anyways. To anyone, and it doesn't matter what their sex is. I have a very good friend of mine, a young man. He just has been offered a position as assistant professor, and I said, Dirk, don't do this, this, or this, but do this, 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 and this. You need advice. I never got any advice at all, and I should have asked. I didn't, but no one ever gave me any advice in these sorts of things, mm-hmm. and you need it. I don't know why, but...
Well, before we talk about your life after work, would you comment on any honors and awards you've received that you're particularly
proud of,
right?
Well, right before I left Texas A&M, I was awarded a very prestigious position, and I didn't stay there. I got an endowed professorship, and that was very nice. Many friends said, Nancy, why did you leave?
Now, how was that funded? Where did it come from?
Well, there's, I don't know exactly how it came about. So that's where I'm not. Maybe I should get more into administration.
Was it the corn growers?
No. Oh no. This, geez, it's something with the university. I don't know how they put it aside. Every university has ways and means of stocking up lots of money. And how they decide to bequeath it, it's unknown to me. I'm not in that area.
Well, it could have been the corn growers then.
Well, they sure wanted me to stay. They did not want me to go. They really did not. They wouldn't have had enough money to fund this as it was forever, but they probably could have had something to do with it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure in fact, maybe they did. I don't know. So that made me feel very good. I actually got two honors there. That was... And I got an honor. There's an award there for female faculty who've made great contributions in research, and I got that before I left too. Haven't gotten anything here, but I was elected to AAAS since I've been here by some I think I know who did it from friends outside of the university.
And so what is AAAS?
Oh, it's a fellowship to the Americans for Advancement of, boy, now it's just an acronym, it's slipping my mind, where's science here. Oh, I'm not good with acronyms. Advancement, yes, I've never been good with this, American something. Okay, what is it? I don't know. Everyone else will know what it is.
Okay, good.
I had people sending me emails saying, hey, congratulations on that. That's anyways, it's a big society in mm-hmm. the U.S. and science.
Mm-hmm.
So that made me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's and little things, nothing real big. So that was nice.
Mm-hmm.
I was, this is sort of funny. But this, I thought, okay, this one is almost funny, really. But it's nice, actually. I was awarded the most distinct, one of, every year they do this, the Distinguished Alumni Award for my high school.
Really?
Yeah, about, was it 3 years ago? Yeah, well, so that was.
That is nice.
Yeah, that was very nice.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back, and this is just hilarious. It was, that was very nice. The hilarious part was, it's a big deal in State College, actually, to get one of these. And they present the award to you during the homecoming football. Football's really big there, just like it is here.
Sure.
And so here, finally, my dream come true. I was never like a queen of the prom or anything in high school, but I got this, and I got to ride on the Cadillac and wave to everybody.
I hope there were pictures.
Oh, yeah, not enough. But what was wonderful, and we're going to this next, is my daughter came with me, and she just loved it. She sat on there with me and threw out candies to other kids. And it ended, it started at high school and ended in the football field. It was great. And my parents came to see it, so that was really nice. I would say for the biggest thing for me is really it just made them feel so proud, so that was really nice.
Yeah. Well, now, will you talk about life after work?
Yeah.
Talk
is,
about
is
your
there
family.
Any, right? Yeah,
how do you balance work and family?
Well,
what do you do for fun? How do you keep healthy? How do you
yeah,
keep energy?
Well, I don't know if I do. If I balance well, I honestly don't. Well, obviously, I'm a mom, and that is my little daughter. You can see, though, that's an older picture. Nina's now 6 years old and full of energy. Well, one thing that's changed for sure with Nina is I have banker's hours, right? You know, I can't. So that was, oh boy, I was a workaholic before. I was always at lab. So that's good, you know, I can't. And you have to think of other things with a family and a little one to take care of. So that's just changed a whole lot. I guess I'm always trying to, like even my cooking and the food we eat has improved. As a vegetarian and I incorporated more protein when I got Nina because I just didn't know if I could get enough protein in her life. So I think having a child or children really does help keep you a little steady because there's almost like two worlds. Though it's real interesting because honestly when I get here, so I keep a picture. Oh, I remember a good friend of mine said, oh Nancy, when you have a child you may not be as enthused for your work anymore. But that's not true at all. Not
mm-hmm.
with me.
Mm-hmm.
But once I'm home with Nina, I'm just thinking of Nina. But then when Nina goes to bed, I flip back and think about here again. So I think, becoming a parent is so different. It's just an area of life you could never even fathom until you're a parent. And it makes you see things about yourself, both honorable and not honorable. I mean, just sorts of things about yourself you'd never know. And it does keep you even, I guess, a little bit, because there's so many things you must think about. And for fun, and I do this a lot, it's now easier for me that she's older. I've always enjoyed to be outside. It's not like I like sports. I'm not a sports player, but I like to keep my body moving. And this probably has helped health-wise, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
I go to the gym a lot.
You look in very good shape.
Thank you. And it's important to me. Not just physically, which it is, but let's say if I have a mental stress, something's bothering me, I go to the gym, I do a workout, I can immediately handle it much better. So it's a great mental release. Mm-hmm. And I feel good. After all these years, I actually do feel good. I'm healthy, I've got energy, I'm in good shape, and you know, you can really tell when you're my age, the people who really keep it up or don't keep it up. And I'm sure it helps with Nina. She's very active. And what's lovely, she's really like riding bicycles. We both like to ride bicycles. She can ride really far now, better than most kids because we started early.
Sure. And
I go swimming a lot. I definitely like summer much, 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 much better. And the winters have not been easy for me to acclimate to.
All after being in Texas.
Yeah. It's much easier to go to a hot place. And I know it's really hot there, but still, if you're there for many years, it's hard to get used to the cold again. Mm-hmm. Now, Nina likes to go sledding. So that's fun. But I don't like being inside, honestly. Unless I'm doing the research, then I don't even know where I am. Mm-hmm. But if it's, I don't like being inside the house.
So are you able to travel? I know you said
earlier. Oh, yeah.
Your daughter go with you?
Yeah, amazingly so. Okay, I must say this, but even I'm amazed with myself here. I've always enjoyed traveling, and I love going to different cultures and trying different foods. I enjoy food and trying different foods very much, too. That's fun for me. And the very nice thing about this work is you're always invited, so you can incorporate research and novel sites. And when Nina first came in my life, of course I'd cut down some of those, but I had to keep up some. I can't tell you how many invitations I get a year ago all over the world. It's just amazing. And then I just said, well, I don't want to say no to these, and it's not good for the profession. So I started incorporating them. And what I've done is I've taken Nina to some. Like one of the first big ones I went to was in Mexico, and actually I had a friend, a Mexican scientist, who had a grad student who took care of Nina during the time I was
nice,
in the day.
Yeah.
And Nina travels so well. She's just amazing. I'm really lucky how well. Well, day one we started traveling, so hey.
Yeah.
And she likes it. She's going to be, man, she'll never want to settle down. Where are we going next? Australia? We went to Australia last year.
Oh, boy.
My brother lives in Australia. So actually, what I do is I pick my meetings. Sometimes I take Nina, and then I'll have someone take care of her. But I started fairly early to maybe, okay, I'll go to a meeting that's just 1 or 2 days, and I have a very trusted friend who'll take care of Nina. Let's see how that goes. Maybe one night. And it worked okay. And this year, actually, I have a very good friend here, Christina Hall, and her husband, Rob Brazis, and I thank them on here. Christina's just a fantastic scientist. I'm so glad she came. But they got a little girl Nina's age, and they took care of Nina for a whole week while I went to a meeting in Europe this year, the first time I was gone so long. And it just worked out fantastic. I mean, Nina, I know she missed me, but she's now sort of used to, okay, my mom travels sometime. And I'm going to a meeting again in Australia in August, taking Nina with me.
And you'll get a chance to see your brother?
Yes, yeah. Anytime I'm invited to Australia, I'll go.
Sure.
That's Nina's only cousins live in Australia, because my other brother, who's in L.A., and I'll stop to see David in L.A. too, he doesn't have any kids.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's... She loves it. She's so excited.
And your parents are still living?
Yeah, in Pennsylvania. Yeah, mm-hmm. In fact, we were just to visit them. We drove all the way from here to there. I like to drive. That was
mm-hmm.
tiring, but I love to drive.
Mm-hmm.
I might, you know, traveling, if everybody doesn't hate people from the United States completely by the time I retire, I might try joining the Peace Corps again. That's
mm-hmm.
been on my mind. I might do that. They like older people to join.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've come to the end of the questions. If there's anything you'd like to add before we turn the tape recorder off, please do.
I can't think of anything, really.
Well, thank you very much. It was an excellent interview.
My pleasure.